How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guests are two of the most respected and highly acclaimed documentary filmmakers of our generation, or of any generation. They have produced illustrious profiles of some of the greatest legendary stars in the history of show business. Their prestigious body of work, which has aired over the years on PBS, TCM, TNT, Stars, and other TV networks, includes three programs about Fred Astaire: Fred Astaire Putting on His Top Hat, Fred Astaire Change Partners and Dance, and The Fred Astaire Songbook, hosted by Audrey Hepburn. They produced two programs about Katharine Hepburn, the first in 1981 entitled Starring Katharine Hepburn, and the second in 1993 entitled Katharine Hepburn, All About Me. And in 1985, they brought us The Spencer Tracy Legacy, a tribute by Katharine Hepburn. Some of their other renowned programs include Judy Garland, The Concert Years, hosted by Judy's daughter, Lorna Luft; James Stewart, A Wonderful Life, hosted by Johnny Carson; Bacall on Bogart, which is a tribute to Humphrey Bogart, hosted by Lauren Bacall; Fonda on Fonda, hosted by Jane Fonda, paying tribute to her father, Henry Fonda; The John Garfield Story; The Adventures of Errol Flynn; and two monumentally important documentaries about Hollywood studios: The Universal Story, honoring the 80th birthday of Universal Studios, hosted by Richard Dreyfuss; and The Lady with the Torch, in honor of the 75th anniversary of Columbia Pictures, hosted by Glenn Close. And let's not forget the terrific profile they produced in 1984 about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, which aired on ABC's 2020. Their programs have received 5 Emmy Awards, 20 Emmy nominations, and dozens of other national and international honors. And in 2015, they wrote a wonderful book entitled In the Company of Legends, which is a must-read for every fan of the golden age of Hollywood. This fascinating book takes us on the remarkable journey of their professional partnership, and we learn what really happened behind the scenes with all the big stars they worked with while making their many brilliant documentaries. I am delighted and deeply honored to welcome Joan Kramer and David Healy to our show. Joan and David, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, thank you for inviting us, but I don't recognize the people you just described.
I do.
I think we can go home now.
Not a chance. Joan, I want to start by mentioning that you started out in the mid-70s working for Dick Cavett on his TV show as assistant talent coordinator. You quickly earned a reputation for booking big stars on the show who were very hard to get. And you've said that working on the Dick Cavett show was one of the best jobs you ever had. What made it so special?
Well, in the first place, the Cavett show was not just a place where people came to plug their most recent film, record, whatever. It was a reflection of the times. And so it was a bit of a, he was always called the intellectual talk show host, which he hated, because he thought of himself as an entertainer.
And he was very funny.
And he was very funny.
And very smart.
Very smart. So, but in my opinion, the experience of working for live television, when we taped it earlier, but it never was edited. So it was taped live to tape, and then aired that night. Amazing things went right and amazing things went wrong. And you never knew at the last minute whether you're going to have somebody drop out, call and say they're sick. And suddenly you're scrambling to find another replacement to be a guest that night. And
didn't you have one person who was always available if you needed him?
Yes. What's his name? Tony Robert Klein was somebody that we could always call on because he lived close by. And the other person that we could always call on was Tony Randall because he lived close by. But over and over again, at the last moment, we taped at 6:30 at night at the Little Theater on 58th Street. And over again, we were scrambling at 5 o'clock. There also were times that, for example, Marlon Brando was due in New York the night before. And when we called the hotel in the morning, he wasn't there. He never checked in. We never told Dick. And we called Marlon Brando. We woke him up in Los Angeles. He was in bed. And we said, we're sending a car. And in those days, you could order a helicopter from the airport. And he was half an hour late, and Dick never knew he wasn't there.
You know, I don't think it's any secret that Dick Cavett is one of my idols and role models. And I'm wondering, have the two of you ever considered doing a profile of him?
Yes.
Yes, we did. Actually, we did. He's one of the many people we had lined up to do a show about. And we did a lot of research. In fact, somewhere on my shelves, I think I've got 20 or 30 videotapes of Dick Cavett shows because we put together a reel, didn't we, at one point?
He narrated a demo reel for us, yes, which we have. And in the end, the residuals to the directors, the writers, yes, yeah, to Dick and all the guests were, and the musicians, were prohibitive.
He's one of those that got away. There's another book about the ones that got away. You know that, Harvey.
David, you had a distinguished career with the BBC before moving to America, and you directed the Nature series for PBS. How did you and John team up?
It was one of those things that I had proposed a show on the local arts to WNET. My proposal didn't go through, but another one did, called Skyline. And it was a half an hour a week on the arts in New York and the New York area. And I was assigned to it as the director. Joan came in as a freelancer initially, I think, yes, on the show as associate producer, right?
Yes. I was writing a couple episodes of the intermission segments for Live from Lincoln Center. And the host of that at that time was Robert McNeil of the McNeil Lehrer Report. And we struck up a conversation because what I didn't know is that Robert McNeil was a great ballet fan and a great movie fan. And so we struck up a conversation about movies and ballet. He was on the board of New York City Ballet or the School of American Ballet. I don't remember which, but anyway. And he said to me, you know, the station is starting an arts program, and I think you'd be very, very appropriate to work on it. And I said to him, well, let me, you know, stupid. I said, let me think about it. He said, well, I'd like to pass along your resume. I said, well, you know, let me think about it. Maybe I should send it myself to the executive producer. He said, I think it would be a little better coming from me. Anyway, I finally saw the light and I gave him my resume and I got a phone call from the executive producer at the time, Gail Jansen. And I went to meet her. And I apparently was the only person that wasn't hired from within the station.
Yeah, that's true. Joan was the odd woman out.
Everybody came from a different department to be on that program except me because I think it's because I had a dance background and she didn't have anybody else with a dance background.
Anyway, we were basically thrown together.
We were thrown together to do a show about that I recommended, God help us, about the set and costume designer, Ruben Terarutunian.
And then John and I did other shows.
Yeah, that's the really wonderful thing, that experience really solidified your knowledge that you two could really work together so well. Now, of course, I want to ask you about some of the programs you made together, starting with the ones about Fred Astaire. What inspired you to make three separate shows about him?
Well, the idea for the first one actually came from Joan, and it also came from one of the shows we did for Skyline. We did a show for Skyline on Rudolf Nureyev. And Joan said to me, Joan had met Rudolf, I should say Nureyev, we didn't call him Rudy, when she did the Cavett show. And she said, both Nureyev and Joanne Woodard, who Joan had also met at the Cavett show, were huge fans of Fred Astaire and said, let's do a show. I'd love to meet Fred Astaire. Joan said, let's do a show about Astaire. We'll get Nureyev and we'll get Joanne Woodard and we'll get Astaire. We'll put them all together. And that was fine, except Astaire said, no way. So, but rather than throw the idea away, we looked in the idea of doing something we'd never done before, which was a portrait of Astaire as a documentary. We were going to do it, basically, we were going to do a conversation, and we did a documentary. And although Astaire actually put up a lot of roadblocks, we did the shows, and they were done for the Pledge Week for public television. And they made a huge amount of money. So the executive in Washington that had basically pushed the shows through called and said, so who are you going to do next? And I said, no, that was it. We just wanted to do a show about Fred Astaire.
Can I interject? That was almost the title of our book, yes. Until somebody pointed out that it may have a different meaning.
So who are you going to do? So I said to him, I said, no, we just wanted to do a show about Astaire. He said, no, the stations want some more. Think of somebody else. And we said, okay, let's have a little conversation. We'll think about some names. And we came up with
Irving Berlin.
Because we'd met him.
We needed Irving Berlin's permission. So we had some contact.
For the Astaire shows.
For the Astaire show's titles.
So it's Berlin and who else?
And Cary Grant.
Oh, Cary Grant. And then and also Katharine Hepburn. And we talked amongst ourselves and we thought, maybe of this group, Irving Berlin's known to be difficult. Cary Grant's on the West Coast. Katharine Hepburn's in New York. So I called up and I said, what do you think about Katharine Hepburn? And he said, call her. Well, it's never that simple.
You got the very last interview with Fred Astaire's sister, Adele, correct?
Yes. We did.
And well, Rudolf Nureyev said he always wanted to meet Fred Astaire and asked you to arrange it. Were you able to make that happen?
I never made that happen. But he was on the Fred Astaire shows as an interviewee. And Joanne Woodward, we went to a party at her house in California when we were out there shooting. And she took David and me by the neck. Each of us by the neck and pushed us into a corner and said, I don't care how you do it. I want to be part of these shows. And David said to me, I don't know what to do with her. She never danced with Astaire. She's not a, she's not a dancer. Let's make her the narrator. She was thrilled. And so was Astaire.
So that was the closest we got. When Nureyev was interviewed for the show, Joanne was the narrator for the show, basically.
Now let's move on to Katharine Hepburn. You had an 18-year professional and personal relationship with her, and you made three films together, two about her, one about Spencer Tracy. Now it's well known that before Katharine Hepburn could trust anyone, she put them through something of an obstacle course. What was that obstacle course like for you?
We didn't know we were being put through an obstacle course.
I think we actually avoided the obstacle.
We avoided it or passed it by default somehow, because when we produced starring Katharine Hepburn for 1981, as you mentioned, she wasn't on it. And by the way, she claimed that she never saw it, which wasn't true. Our spies told us.
We had spies.
Well, she'd seen the show. And that, I think, was the obstacle course. As a result of how we did the show and how we handled her story, I think particularly how we handled her story vis-a-vis Spencer Tracy at that point, she decided she could trust us. And the people around her, her friend Laura Harding, who went to Hollywood with her, and George Cukor, who was instrumental in helping us get her, I think they were very, very influential in helping her understand that they knew us and they think we were okay.
The bottom line is
we weren't going to hurt her.
That doing that show was a substitute for her usual obstacle course. She realized when she saw the show that we were trustworthy, that we would tell her story straight, and that we wouldn't basically do things to hurt her.
Well, in your book, you described her as extremely bright, strong-willed, and you said that she carefully constructed her own public image in a way to keep the public fascinated with her. Was there ever a struggle between her desire to control her public image and your desire to show us the real person?
Not once.
I don't think it, no, it never came into conflict.
Not once did she ever ask what we're shooting,
no,
how we're shooting it. Can she please see a playback? She never asked what clips we were using from films, how much we were using. Never.
She was only helpful when we had problems. Like we did, for example, we needed, when you do things, doing shows like this, getting the clips, getting the rights to things to show, people think that's a piece of cake. That's a huge issue we have to deal with. And when we were doing the first show about her, we knew we had to show the Philadelphia Story. It was a turning point in her career, but that was owned by MGM. MGM had just issued That's Entertainment and was making a huge amount of money on That's Entertainment. So they didn't want to dilute that by letting those clips go somewhere else. So initially when we said, could we get the Philadelphia Story? They said, no, she helped us get it. She basically said, what was it? She said, who's
that man that runs MGM that these days? She said, is it that man who got himself in trouble, which I laughed at. And I think it's interesting that David Beagleman, despite getting himself in trouble, wound up as the president of MGM. But nevertheless, she said, I can try and call him, but I don't know if he'll take my call. I said, I think he might. And she did. And she called us back and she said, there's no problem. He said, you can have anything you want.
She was
she was an ace in the hole, yes, when it came to.
If ever we had big problems, I mean, we didn't use her as unless we really had to, but we knew she was our secret ammunition.
Well, that's for sure. Now, as you know, Katharine Hepburn almost never talked publicly about her 27-year relationship with Spencer Tracy. And yet she actually approached you to do a program about him and she wanted to host it. Were you shocked when she suggested that?
Let me just say, that came out of starring Katharine Hepburn, because basically she eventually said, come to tea. So we met her in person and we went to tea a few times there.
Then
Joan is sitting in her office, which is across the corridor from me, and her phone rings.
And let me just say, Harvey, if she calls you, she had an expression, pull yourself together. When I called her, I would pull myself together to get ready to talk to her. When she called me and I answered the phone and that voice is on the other end, believe me, it's a shocker. Okay. And so she said, hi, it's Kate. I said, and I don't know what I said, something really stupid to tune in. I said something like, oh, good morning. How are you?
That's a good line.
And without telling me how she was, she said, now that I have friends at public television, why don't we do a show together about Spencer? I, as you probably can gather, Harvey, I'm not often speechless. I was speechless. I said, and I don't know how I had the guts to do this, but I said, Miss Hepburn, that's an amazing idea. I mean, it's a wonderful idea. I've got somebody on my other line. Could you just let me put you on hold for 1 second to get rid of them? And I'll be right back. And she said, sure, go ahead. And I put her on hold and I screamed, David, get in here immediately, from across the hall. He thought I saw a mouse. Channel 13 had mice and I don't like mice. Okay. And they used to run around and I used to scream every time I saw one. So David came running. And I said, Katharine Hepburn's on my phone, and she just asked us to do a show about Spencer Tracy. And very calmly, Mr. British stands there and says, ask her if she'll host it. So I pushed the button again without thinking. Adrenaline was, and I pushed the button and I said, Miss Hepburn, I'm back. Would you be willing to host a show about Spencer Tracy? What the hell do you think I'm talking about? Come to tea tomorrow and we'll talk about it.
Unbelievable.
And unbelievable.
David, what was it like directing Katharine Hepburn? Was she nervous?
That's a whole book, Harvey, which I should write. Some of it's in our book, of course. Well, first of all, by that time, we did know her. We were she was comfortable with us, and I was, and we were comfortable with her. And you have to understand something. She came from the movie background where she was used to working with directors. And of course, her relationship with the directors, I think we all well know, is that it was a two-way relationship. She often told George Cukor how he should set up his shots and so on. But the bottom line is she was used to that relationship. So we worked our way up slowly. We talked to her about what the show was going to be. And by the time we came to the first shooting, we had it all planned out. However, I said to her before we went out to LA to do the first shooting, I said, "Miss Hepburn, here's an important thing. You don't have to memorize the script. It's going to be on a prompter. You'll just read it off a teleprompter in front of the camera. So don't worry about memorizing it. It'll just be there for you to see." She said, "Oh, okay." And then I said, "Do you have any problem with distance vision?" No. I'm falling apart, but my eyesight's fine. So we get to the first shot, which is actually on the...
Wait a minute. When you told her that, she said, "Well, why don't..." Oh, yes. "Wouldn't it be better..." She never told him what to do. No. She'd say, "Why don't you consider standing next to the camera and I'll talk to you?"
"I just talk to you," she said. And I said, you know, at one point, even with Katharine Hepburn, you realize you've got to put your foot down. I said, "Miss Hepburn, no, you are the host of the show. You're talking to the viewer. You're not talking to me. You have to look into the camera lens and talk to the viewer." Remember, she'd never looked into a camera lens in her life before. In fact, you're told never to do that in the movies. So we get to the opening.
Well, tell her tell her the reaction.
Oh, she said, what did she say?
Well, he said, "You've got to look into the camera because you're talking to the viewer as the host." And she said, "Hmm." Yes. And David said, "He should have recognized the hmm."
How significant that hmm was. So here we are on a golf course early in the morning, and I'm with the camera crew. It's very early. I'm with the camera crew setting up the shot. Joan has been waiting for Hepburn at the lobby. Riviera Country Club in the lobby. And we won't bore you with all the stories that lead up to this, but She and Hepburn come down to the site and she's chatting with Hepburn. I go over and I say, "Good morning, Miss Hepburn. Just give me a couple of minutes with you. I'm still setting up the shop." I'll go back to the camera crew. Joan comes over to me and she says, "David, we have a problem."
It's not what you want to hear on the first day as the director of Katharine Hepburn, right?
She said, "You've got to come here." So I go to Miss Hepburn, as she was at that time. And I said, "What's the problem, Miss Hepburn?" "If I'd known I had to wear one of these, I would never have agreed to do this. They work in Spain, they never work here." She was talking about a radio mic. She didn't want to wear the radio mic. So this is the first thing I had to deal with. And I don't know how, but I somehow calmed her down. And I said, "Miss Hepburn, it's the only way we can get the sound here in the middle of the golf course. Will you just please, just please try this once? If it doesn't work, we'll find something else." Okay, I'll do it.
We didn't have anything else, by the way.
There was no backup plan. No plan. So we eventually get her to put on the radio mic. She's ready to go in front of the camera. And I said, "Miss Heaven, let's just make sure the camera's at a close enough distance for you to see it. Let's just read through the prompter." She says, "Okay." So I'm standing right next to her. The camera's over there. I said to the prompter guy, "Roll the prompter."
No, with the eyes.
I can't see it. Miss Hepburn, maybe you could just take a few steps towards the camera. Maybe you will just see a bit better. This is a woman who had no problem with her eyesight, remember? So she takes a few steps towards the camera. I said to the prompter guy, "Let's roll it again. Let's rehearse it." "This is absolutely useless. It will not work." I'm thinking, oh, this is the first shot of this huge documentary that PBS has already paid for. We're doing our first shoot in LA and our careers are going down the tubes. I can see that straight away. So I had to come up with something. And of course, at the time I thought I was being brilliant, but looking back, it was the only solution. I said to Miss Hepburn, "You know, you don't need a script. We talked through this yesterday. You know what happens here. This is where you and Spencer shot the scenes for Pat and Mike, and this is the Riviera Country. Just tell us the story. You know what the story is. You don't need the prompter."
She said, "Oh yeah, okay." I said, "Let's just try a little run through." And as I'm walking back to the camera, she's actually doing it. And of course she did know the story. And just leaving her just to tell the story like that, she was wonderful.
David, you are brilliant. Now, your film...
I thought at the time, but I wasn't really.
You really, really are. I'm telling you, your film about Katharine Hepburn entitled All About Me was hosted by Miss Hepburn herself, but the two of you wrote it. What was it like writing what she was going to say about herself?
We had a template, because before we did it, we actually sat her down and did just like a backup interview just to make sure that we had everything. And so we kind of had her words telling the story. But then, as you say, we actually had to write the script down for her to read.
And that was scary, because you're reading your version of her life to the person whose life it is, let alone being Katharine Hepburn. And she was fine.
We called her up and we said, "Miss Hepburn, we have a draft of the script. Our office was only like 5 blocks away. Could we come down for you to read through it and see what you think?" She said, yes, come down. I'm here now. Come straight away. So we go down. Now, can you imagine what it's like? You've written her life story for her to tell, but you've written the words. And so she's reading through it. And I think both our hearts were in our mouths the whole time this was going on. And she reads through and she's fine. Then she comes to one point in the script and she stops. And I know where the point is. It's where we wrote, she went to Hollywood with her friend Laura Harding. And there were all sorts of rumors about Kate and Laura, this being Hollywood, of course. So we wrote in the script, "Some people said that Laura and I were more than just friends." And she reads that part in the script and she stops. And I thought, oh, this is where we're going to get thrown out in the street. Mm-hmm. And she stops and then she says, she turns to us and she said, "Won't they let you say lesbian?"
Wow. In 2000,
they will, but we thought it was more fun this way.
Oh, it was brilliant. In 2022, a new documentary about Katharine Hepburn was released on Netflix called Call Me Kate. Did you see it?
Yes.
I did not.
I saw it.
What did you think of it, David?
Well, first of all, they didn't have much new material in it. Secondly, they had somebody being Katharine Hepburn, which kind of bothered me, you know, reading as though it was Katharine Hepburn. And the other thing is they actually faked things. They said this is a screen test that she used to go to Hollywood. It wasn't, it was something else. So that really upset me. I can understand why people enjoyed it, because it was an enjoyable piece, but to me it had too many flaws. Of course,
we're a little prejudiced.
More than a little prejudiced.
There's no question that your films are absolutely authoritative. And let's face it, she's in the last two of them. Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, your profile of Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward was broadcast on the ABC show 2020. I was surprised to read in your book that Paul and Joanne wanted Hugh Downs to be the one to interview them, not Barbara Walters. Did you ever find out why they did not want her?
Absolutely. Paul had done one of Barbara Walters' celebrity interviews. I think they usually aired around the time of the Oscars. Yes. She used to do a special. And he had done an interview with her in which she said to him, "You know, I can't talk to you about your life and career without asking you about your beautiful blue eyes," which he despised. And he said to her, "It does make me feel like a piece of meat." And when it came time to do 2020, for us to do 2020, they said, "We'll do it if it's with Hugh Downs. We do not want Barbara Walters," which Barbara Walters was not happy about.
Mm-hmm. Well, she got her revenge by making you cut 5 minutes out of your film.
That's exactly the point. And it took us all night in an edit room to take out those 5 minutes. Because as you very well, you can't just take 5 minutes and chop it out. It doesn't work that way. It took us all night. And she was actually told how long her piece should have been. And she went straight up to the president of ABC News to say, I can't cut it. I want my piece 5 minutes longer.
And she had a lot of power. Didn't
she? And she had a lot of clout. Yeah.
So there you go. She got her revenge. Now, in your program about Newman and Woodward, Gore Vidal said something really interesting. He said their marriage worked so well because they had nothing in common. Joan, you knew them very well. Do you agree with Gore Vidal?
Well, in the first place, I know what he means. I mean, he loved racing. She loved the ballet. She loved the opera. He loved meat. At that time, she was a vegetarian. I mean, they had their family in common, and they had an undeniable tie to each other. They each had something that the other one didn't. And I always felt, I don't know if it's true, but I always felt that that bond was somehow based on the fact that Joanne, by her own admission, started out as a young kid wanting to be a movie star and famous. Paul started out wanting to be an actor. As it turned out, the opposite happened to each of them. He became a good actor, but he had to work really hard. She was born with an acting talent in her toes. She could do anything as an actress, and he knew it. And she knew how famous he was. She told me once, you know, all he has to do is snap his fingers and he can get a movie made. I have to work very hard in order to convince people that I want to do such and such.
Yes, she used to say, I can't even get a check cash. They don't know who I am.
So maybe Barbara Walters wasn't so wrong when she mentioned those blue eyes. Just saying.
Now, you know what his great phrase was? His great phrase was his epitaph. I don't think it does, but I don't know. His epitaph is going to read, he was a great actor until his eyes turned brown.
Very funny. Now, of course, I have to ask you about one of my all-time favorite documentaries, Judy Garland, The Concert Years. What was it like dealing with Judy's ex-husband, the notorious Sid Luft?
Notorious.
It was, let's put it this way, you were always nervous that he was going to pull something out. I think the first time we went to meet him, he said at the end of the, we went to his apartment in LA, and he said at the end of the meeting, he said, by the way, you know, I recorded all this. But he was playing with us. He knew his reputation, and he was playing with it. He could be absolutely charming. When you met him and you spent some time with him, you could understand why Judy fell for him. Because he was also she needed a very strong figure at that point in her career. And he provided that. But he was also a...
con artist.
That's right. I mean, he was a tough person to play with.
He didn't care how many lawsuits came his way. He realized that by the time they came to court or they even got anywhere, he'd probably be dead.
It's too late.
And he didn't care. You know, he just went around his business taking and doing and showing. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole story about whether he really owns the clip of Barbara Streisand and Judy when Barbara appeared on his show. And she claims, she told me she owns it.
The reason that we worked with him is because he had managed, by ways which are very complex, to acquire the rights to all the recordings of Judy Garland's TV series from CBS. It's still kind of a little bit this, but he had them, and he had the Kinneys. He had the actual recordings. So he did a deal with Channel 13, with PBS. He said, look, I'll provide you with the materials. You make the show, and we'll jointly own the rights in the end. Part of the deal was he was supposed to clear all the rights and everything we did.
He didn't.
Yeah, that's what I've heard about Sid Luft. Although I have to tell you both, I was very touched. When you showed the finished program of Judy Garland, The Concert Years, to Sid Luft, he was sobbing.
He was.
To me, that means that he never stopped loving her.
Sid Luft adored her.
It was real.
Absolutely loved her. And there was no question in our minds that that was a true love. I don't know what it was like from her to him. She wasn't alive. According to Lorna, that was a marriage that was complicated, but they stayed together.
He also revived her career, let's face it.
I mean, he revived her career.
He really brought her back to the concert. I mean, He's a very complicated person, said he. It's not all good and it's not all bad, but he's a man with a huge amount of energy that got things done.
And he, you know, I think you know the story. The only version that we had of her singing Over the Rainbow, you and I know, you can't do a show on Judy Garland without including Over the Rainbow unless you want people to throw things at a television, right? And the only version we had was the one on her show with Joey and Lorna. And
it was the Christmas show.
Joey doesn't stop talking in the middle of the song.
It's not, in other words, it's not her best version of Over the Rainbow.
It's not good. And we knew that Sid had the ending of her 1955 special, in which I think it's the only version in which she did what she did on her concert tours, which is to do the Tramp number and then sit on the stage and do Over the Rainbow as the end of the concert. And the only version of that combination of her sitting in the Tramp costume, Sid owned from that last 19, from that 55.
And he showed it. And then he said, you can't have it.
It's most prized possession. I don't want it ever to be seen. Da, 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 da. Well, anyway, Lorna, who was our host, came to see a rough cut in our office. And we get to the end of the show and she said, you can't use that version of Over the Rainbow. Joey doesn't keep his mouth shut. She said, where's the other version that my father owns of her in the Tramp costume? I said, he won't give it to us because it's his most prized possession. She says, what time is it? And I said, why? I said, it's 2:00. Good. Early enough to make the afternoon edition of the New York Post, Daughter Kills Father. Let's get him on the phone. So we dialed Sid in California and he said, hi, Lorna. She said, don't tie me. Sydney, she with a voice, Sydney, I want that tape of Mama singing Over the Rainbow in the Tramp costume in FedEx immediately.
We got it the next day.
She said, if you ever want to see your grandchildren again, and I have the only two of them, you better get that tape in FedEx now.
And as you know, it's the climax of our show.
Oh, there, that would not have been the movie it was without that. That number for sure.
There's wonderful stuff in the show. I mean, some absolutely spectacular performances by Judy in the show.
I think it's your most entertaining documentary.
Pure entertainment.
Pure entertainment. I want to ask you about your film about
Astaire. I think Astaire is pure entertainment too, don't you?
Yeah, but nothing tops Judy, not in my book.
Well, okay.
your film about Jimmy Stewart was extremely well done. What gave you the idea to have Johnny Carson be the host?
Well, okay. We'd basically got the show lined up. Most of it was all lined up. MGM was our co-producer. We needed them on board because they had all the clips. And we were literally in the car in LA on our way to a meeting at MGM. And I said to Joan, you know, they're going to ask us who we're thinking should host the show. And we hadn't thought about it. I mean, it's hard to believe. We just hadn't thought about it. So in the car, we started coming up back to this. And I said to Joan, you know, Jimmy's so often on The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson would probably be quite a good host, but, you know, we'll never get him. But of course, stupid us in the meeting, we said, how about Johnny Carson? They said, get him.
Slam dunk, get him.
Get him.
And so...
And you probably know that Johnny did nothing other than Tonight Show and occasionally the Oscars. He never did anything else.
Well, you got him. And you said that you enjoyed working with Johnny Carson so much that you asked him to consider hosting other shows you were considering about Jack Benny, Bob Hope, George Burns, and Johnny refused every one of them. Did he say why?
Yes. He said...
Let's just say something first. Johnny really enjoyed himself doing our show. And he was, for all the things we'd heard about him being difficult, he was a joy to work with. Just absolutely wonderful.
And really protective of Jimmy. They were
The two of them together was magic.
They were they were a mutual admiration society. Jimmy kept coming to me and saying, isn't it wonderful of John to be doing this. And then he'd tell it to Johnny. And Johnny would come to me and say, if he tells me one more time how wonderful it is of me to be doing this, I'm going to strangle him. Doesn't he know who he is? I said, no, he thinks you're the big star here today.
I'm going to interrupt Joan for a second here, because we thought we did the show with Johnny, that would be, you know, and he said, come to the show, and we'll meet me afterwards. We weren't one of his tonight shows. I was sitting in the office in New York, and I'd hear Joan's phone ring, and she'd pick up and she'd say, oh, hello, Johnny. Johnny would call her and chat with her.
Yeah, we had a lot of conversations.
So then why didn't he want to do more documentaries with you?
Well, we thought it would be a slam dunk to get him to do some more.
Well, he said, if Jack Benny were alive, I would do it in a heartbeat. But I'm not good at going on television and talking to nobody. I'm not good at that. He knew exactly what he was good at. He said, I don't feel about Bob Hope or George Burns the way I feel about Jimmy Stewart. So if you find another person that you want to do a show about that's alive, that I can talk to, that I feel as strongly about as I do about Jimmy Stewart and Jack Benny, were he alive, I'd be happy to work with you again. We never did.
Couldn't find anybody else, which is a shame.
When you were filming Jimmy Stewart for your film, did you try to get him to talk about being a pilot during the war?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That part of Jimmy is what a lot of people don't know about, of course. I mean, now they do, but back then he was just the actor on the screen who did just a wonderful life and the Westerns and all those great movies. But he had a secret life in the war. He was a pilot. And if you've seen, I watched the series that was on recently about the bombers that went into Europe. Oh, Masters of the Air. He was one of those pilots that flew bombers from bases in Britain over
25 bombing mission. He was the lead pilot.
And he was a tough guy. He was a really tough guy. And so, but we knew that was not something that he basically wanted to boast about.
Or even talk about.
So as part of the show, I mean, there was the interviews he did with Johnny, but before we did that, we sat him down in his living room. And I did an interview with him, basically, which covered his entire life. You don't see me, of course. You see his answers. And at one point, I said to him, he was very relaxed. He was easygoing. He was telling all these wonderful stories. And I said, Mr. Stewart, could you tell us what it was like to do a typical bombing mission over Germany? No. That was that. He would not talk about it.
And he wouldn't say why?
David didn't push it.
yes, hero that I am, I didn't pursue it any further. But when we had him together with Johnny, we had Johnny ask him some questions in a very delicate way, which led us into that part of his life.
And we did get his commanding officer, Ramsey Potts, on the show.
We found his commanding officer and put him on the show. So he told us about Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, that was really wonderful. Now, Joan and David, there's a theme that runs through your book, and it has to do with the many obstacles you both had to overcome in getting your films made, especially getting financing, getting access to rare materials, getting the rights to use film clips from classic movies, and getting many great stars to cooperate with you and appear on screen after they had forcefully refused. What was your secret to getting the most powerful people in Hollywood to say yes after adamantly saying no?
No.
Can I tell you something? We didn't give up.
Yes. You basically, it's like when the first Astaire show, when we contacted his agent, we'd like to say we want to do this show on Fred Astaire.
And we wrote him a letter.
And we wrote him a letter. And basically, to put it bluntly, we were told, get lost. And we didn't get lost. We tried again and again. And eventually his agent called up and he said, look, Mr. Astaire says because of your
tenacity,
he's going to give you permission to do the show. And we're thinking, we don't need permission. He's a public figure. No, big deal. Well, in fact, we did because his lawyer back in the 30s wrote in his contract that he controlled the clips.
In days that nobody used clips except for trailers.
But so the fact was, it was a big deal that he said yes. And then his agent said to us, oh, and by the way, he owns his last TV show and wonders if you'd like to use a clip from that. So we went from get lost, I don't want to hear from you. Here's a clip. Here's
and
some
you know,
stuff you can
Harvey,
use.
To this day, I've said to David often, you know, our track record was only in local documentaries like Nureyev, Patricia Birch, Lottie Lenya. I don't know how we ever got Fred Astaire to back down and let us do it.
I think it's what you said. It's the persistence. It's the tenacity. And I can tell you that I'm so inspired by that, because when I started this show, everyone said to me, well, how do you think you're going to get big stars to come and talk to you on a show? You know, nobody knows you. And I did exactly what you did. I just don't give up.
You're polite, but persistent.
You also have to walk a fine line in where you don't become obnoxious.
Yes.
Right. Now, I have to ask you this. When you finished making a movie and it turns out to be a huge success, does that help you forget all the stress you went through to make it?
Until you're writing the book, and then it all comes back. It comes gushing back about all the stress.
Well, I'll tell you a perfect example. You know, doing the two studios documentaries, Universal followed, and then Columbia. We never did a studio show before. And how do you do a studio show telling the story through the movies when nobody ever made movies that were meant to go together in a documentary? So one of my greatest accomplishments in the Columbia show, I'm doing a slight distraction here, but one of my great accomplishments, in my opinion, is figuring out a way to connect Tutsi to Gandhi. Somebody said, how did you do that? Another man who wore a dress? And I said, no, give me a little more credit than that. I said, and I think the line was, another man who found a unique way of reaching his goals.
Yeah, those documentaries are amazing. I will ask you about them. But I'm just wondering what it must have felt like to screen a program for a big star who is the subject of the show. Did you ever worry that they might want you to make last minute changes?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, the first one, of course, was Astaire, because part of the deal with Astaire was that his agent said, you know, he's given you permission and he'd let you use the script, but it will be a good idea if you showed him the rough cut before you put the show to bed. And I'm thinking, oh my God, Astaire's known to be super critical about everything. I mean, he'd have films pulled back. He'd tell Archeo to pull all the prints in because he didn't like something. So when we went to screen the show with him, I was not feeling well that day, but that's beside the point. We very carefully put him in front of us so we could watch him watching the screen.
And he came with the agent.
And of course, our hearts were in our mouths.
And you have to understand the technology at that time in 1980.
Oh, God. What we were showing was, to call it a rough cut is being kind, because we didn't have the commentary, and it was my voice pretending to be Joanne Woodward. A lot of the inserts, the stills, were not even there yet.
Black holes.
And the actual recordings of his performances were very low quality. We were going to put high quality versions in for the air tape, but this rough cut, it looked like CRAP, to be honest with you. And I thought, I don't know how he's going to deal with this. But we sat behind him, and the opening number is putting on his top hat. And we watched him, and we noticed he was tapping his foot, watching himself perform.
And it
dawned on us both later. He hadn't seen these things in years.
Not only that, but we read often enough.
Oh, yes.
What he hated was people showing little bits and pieces of his dancing.
Yes.
We tried as often as possible to show full numbers, and that was the first one. And it goes on a long time. And as he was tapping his feet, and it gets to the end, you know the number where he uses cane to sort of shoot down the dancers in back of him. He said, when I get to the last guy, I'll tell you a story. And so I thought, oh, good, something good is coming. He got to the last guy, and the story was that guy wound up as a fireman on the Warner Brothers lot.
That was a great Fred Astaire story.
Fred Astaire was not a great talker.
Now, David, of all the great superstars that you've interviewed, you said that your favorite one was Steven Spielberg. Why?
Over the years, you know this, Albert, you do lots and lots of interviews with people, and sometimes it's a bit like pulling teeth. Spielberg's a filmmaker. So Spielberg knew what, when I, asked him a question. He knew exactly why I was asking the question. He knew how it was going to fit into the program. He told his stories almost pre-editing them in his own mind. And at one point, he told us a story about somebody. He said, now, that might not be the right person. Let me give you an insert, and I'll tell you a bit. You can insert this, and he'd give it another name. But the bottom line, he was being a filmmaker as he was being interviewed. That makes it really easy.
Well, let me ask you about some of your least favorite interviewers, starting with Mickey Rooney, who you described as a disappointment. What was so disappointing about Mickey Rooney?
Well, he was a blowhard. I mean, before the camera, is that the right word?
A blowhard, yes.
Before the camera rolled, he was telling stories about how much he hated Hollywood, how much his career was ruined by various people, how everybody is no good in Hollywood, et cetera, et cetera. Then the camera comes on and he becomes, Spencer Tracy was so wonderful.
It's all sugar and syrup.
It was so syrupy and so boring that we hardly could use any of it.
You know, what you don't want in an interview for the shows that we're doing is somebody say, oh yes, they were wonderful. That doesn't do anything for you.
And I don't like people telling me over and over again what a genius somebody is.
You're looking for stories and analysis is what you're really looking for to tell your story.
So he was really pretty hollow. Now, you said that Harvey Keitel was the most difficult person you've ever interviewed. About him that was so difficult?
Well, first of all, he hated me. I don't know why, but he hated me.
When we did the interview with him in LA, Joan did the interview and he took an instant dislike to Joan. I don't know why.
He was late. He was held up somewhere and we did it in somebody's house that he knew. And he was not nice. And, you know, I mean, he really was antagonistic towards me. And I thought, this is not going very well. But he then asked not to have anything used.
The interview was not bad, by the way. You know,
it wasn't bad.
Even though he basically didn't like the interview, some of his responses.
I don't know.
Bad.
Maybe because he would have preferred a man to interview. Who knows? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, you guys have dealt with every personality. David, you are well known for being very calm, even tempered. But only one celebrity has been able to make you lose your cool, and it was Lauren Bacall. Tell us about that.
You know, Bacall was an absolutely fascinating person, because I've been looking recently about the very first interview we did with her, which was for starring Katharine Hepburn. And she was wonderful. She was warm. She was laughing. She was telling all these wonderful stories. When we came to do the show about Bogart, she was the host, and it was a different person. She was very much on guard the whole time, and... Oh, God.
She didn't like anything that was written for her.
Yeah.
The day went on and on. Then she wandered around the Warner Brothers lot I was there, and she was asking for things out of the prop department. And we also had a prop Maltese Falcon. And she said, I'd like to take that home.
Now, you can't do that. Let's just say all she did on camera, that was wonderful. It was quite wonderful. She was really terrific. Then we came to the point where we'd done the whole show. We just needed the narration track. It was all edited and we'd written a narration and she was going to do the narration. So we called her up and said, we need a narration session with you. And we gave her a date. And she said, oh, I'm not coming to that.
By the way, the date was preset. That wasn't that day.
No.
We had all the dates preset with her, which she approved in writing.
Yeah, that's right. She knew a long time ago when this was going to happen. She says, I'm not going to come to that. I'm going to a party in London. So Joan gets on the phone.
I got on the phone with her agent. And his name was Hal Ross. And I said, look, Hal, here's the proposal. She agreed to preset dates. We have it in writing. He said, yes, but she has to go to this party, so she can't be there. So here's the thing. You're going to have to go to London to do the narration. I said, we don't have the budget. This is public television. We don't have the timetable for the air date.
We run a very tight schedule.
And we don't have the budget for us to go to London to rent a recording studio for her to do it in. So therefore, here's the deal, okay? I said, either she shows up as she promised at the recording session on time, or we will hire an anonymous voice to narrate the program of her husband.
She turned up.
He called back. He said, I'll get back to you.
Good for you.
My mother had an expression. My daughter's a very good-natured person. Don't push her against the wall. She'll push back.
Well, as you should in this business. You know, you wrote something very interesting in your book. You said that you believe Lauren Bacall's difficult persona was the armor she used to protect herself from being disappointed or hurt or taken advantage of by others. You know, I think that's true.
We had this tough time with her to the point where it's in the book where I actually walk out on her at one point, but that's the story in the book. And she comes back and then she says, okay, let's do it.
She says, sometimes I don't handle myself very well when I'm under stress.
But you know, once we got over that, she was wonderful. And we went
out. You two should really write a book about how to handle celebrities because it really is an art and you two have mastered it. Now, one of the reasons I very much wanted to have the two of you on our show is to tell you that several years ago, we had Errol Flynn's daughter, Rory, on our show. And she told me privately after we finished filming that she very much regretted her decision not to participate in your film about her father.
She told me that too. Yeah.
She said it was a really big missed opportunity. And I never thought at the time I would get a chance to meet you and tell you what she told me. So I'm glad I could tell you now.
That thank was you, very Harvey. Nice of her. She did tell that to me.
Harvey, thank you.
Thank you for that.
That's nice.
We asked Rory to be on the show. And Rory said to me, I'm not going to do anything until I see a script. And I said, Rory, I don't think you're quite aware of how a documentary is made. The script is built around the interviews. And the clips.
There's no script until the last few days.
until we have the interviews and we know what people are going to talk about and how they fit into the picture of the jigsaw puzzle of the clips and the stills and the interviews.
But of course, look, Rory knew what had been written and said about her father in the past. She knew the sort of piece that could be done about her. And she was, I think, protecting him. Because there's so much rubbish being written and said and filmed about Errol Flynn, who is in fact an incredibly fascinating person. That's the last documentary we did, by the way.
And a damn good actor, which he was never given credit for because of his Playboy reputation.
And I think it's one of the best shows we did.
It was one of your best shows. I can tell you that it took me months and months to get her to come on our show. She's never given an interview to anybody else on anybody else's show. So I'm so glad that she did. And of course, I have to ask you about interviewing Olivia de Havilland, which for me was the highlight of your Errol Flynn film.
Yes, it was for us too.
When she said that while kissing Errol Flynn during the filming of Robin Hood, Errol had a little trouble with his tights. Weren't you shocked?
Trouble with his tights.
Weren't you absolutely shocked?
Because she's so prim and proper, right? You sing this grand dame and she tells you that story.
And we had a whole talk with her the day before, all well into the night. And she never told us that was going to come out of her mouth. David, I think, was going to fall off the chair. I remember my mouth dropping open. The crew had to keep quiet, but they were...
The crew was like...
So, of course, you know, I had to go back and watch Robin Hood. And after every kissing scene, my eyes were on his crotch.
Isn't it a wonderful story, though?
I mean, now, one of your most prestigious programs was Broadway's Dreamers, The Legacy of the Group Theater, which won an Emmy Award. Did you face any repercussions for featuring Elia Kazan in the program, given his cooperation with Senator McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Committee?
Well,
no repercussions, but it was delicate. It was very delicate.
Everybody else that was on that show said to me and David, we'll be happy to participate if we don't have to be in the same room with him, because he named them during the House Un-American Activities Committee. He ruined many of their lives. Yeah. Ruth Nelson, Margaret Barker, Tony Kraber, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so at the end of the show, he did do an interview, not very good. He did it at Joanne's barn, in her barn. And she was asking questions and he would answer by saying, read the book. He just finished a book.
It's like us saying, oh, we don't tell you that story. Read our
book. You know, Harvey, we don't have to tell you that. Read the book. It was okay. He never You see, the problem with him is that he never capitulated, that he did the wrong thing. Other people name names, sometimes excusing themselves for naming names by saying, well, I named names of people that other people had already named.
Well, I mean, look at Clifford Odets. But Clifford Odets and John Garfield were great friends as kids. And then Clifford goes and basically...
Yeah, but it's interesting. But anyway, the point is that Joanne then gave a rap party at the end of the show, which took, by the way, 5.5 years to do. And she called me one morning and she said to me, what am I going to do about Gadge? You know, he was known as Gadge by his friends. What am I going to do? I can't invite him to the party. Nobody will come. And I said, And she said, I know what I'm going to do. I'll call you back in 20 minutes. She called back and she said, I called him and I told him the truth. She says, he's not stupid. He knows what happened. And I said to him, Gadge, I'm giving this rap party for the group theater. You were part of it. I'm sorry, I can't invite you because nobody else will show up. So why don't you and Paul and I have dinner next week together, just the three of us? And that was the solution.
Well, you have to lie in the bed that you make, you know. I have to tell you, I really enjoyed your movies about Universal Studios and Columbia Pictures. You wrote in your book that the major challenge of those two programs was to make the audience care about a corporation. So what was your approach to overcoming that challenge?
I don't know, actually.
Well, we knew we had to tell the story through the movies. Yes. And that, what I said earlier, they didn't make movies that were meant to ever go together. So we had to find little clumps. Like in the Columbia show, we did a clump of the story of Rita Hayworth. Frank Capra. Yeah. And in the Universal show, there was a given. You do a clump about the monster movies because they were famous for their horror films. And we decided that everybody that we interviewed and didn't interview, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. The studio had a lot of interviews that they did when they made movies about, for example, Tootsie. They had Dustin Hoffman already interviewed, although we interviewed him again. But some of the people that they had interviews of, we didn't get. They just let us use Julia Roberts talking about my best friend's wedding. And we decided, as a result of them having interviews, and them having interviews sometimes with people no longer alive, we would only do interviews, audio only, so that everybody became equal.
For example, there was a wonderful interview with Boris Karloff, but it was just an audio interview. So we said, let's make everybody even. We're not going to interrupt the movies by having on-camera interviews. We did everybody voiceover. The thing is, Harvey, in the end, if you look at these, it's incredible hard work, by the way, going through 100 years of movies or whatever it is. But
it was like two kids in a candy shop. We were given access to anything we wanted.
In a way, but it was a huge amount of work.
I mean, at one time, I think we had 1,000 titles in our show on 3/4 inch.
Yeah.
Those documentaries are absolute must-sees for any Hollywood buff. And I have to tell you both, I was extremely impressed that you were able to get close to the elusive Lou Wasserman, who was chairman of MCA Universal, widely considered to be the most powerful person in the history of Hollywood. You had a very special friendship with him, and you got the very last photo ever taken of him the last time you saw him, May 10th, 2002. That's amazing.
Charmed him.
First of all, he was a flirt. He was a flirt. We would go and we would be led to parking spot number one, which was his spot on the lot. We would either have lunch with him in the commissary, or he would say to us in his office, I have to throw you out now. I have a lunch date, but come on, I'll get you a good table downstairs. We went to his house and he showed us he had an enormous collection of memorabilia, and it wasn't a cosmetic collection. He knew everything that was in it, and he pulled books out for us, showing us the stag book, the book that he made for the stag party of Jimmy Stewart, which he gave. He said he promised Gloria that Gloria Stewart, whom Jimmy was married to all those years, but before they were married and he was giving him a stag party, Gloria said, Lou, I don't want any nude women. I don't want strippers there.
But your question really was, how did we get to that relationship?
Lou Wasserman was the first person we asked to meet, because the studio had decided, through a friend of ours, to hire us as outsiders. Nobody at the studio, or very few people at the studio, ever knew who we were. Can you imagine calling up the film clip department and saying, I need 1,000 titles sent to me on 3/4 inch? They'd say, who are these crazy people? By the time they figured out that this was a real project, we would have been over budget and not on the timetable to meet the anniversary. By the way, why don't you ask why it was their 80th anniversary instead of the 75th?
Forgot.
Yeah, they forgot. You know, it's just fascinating the lives that you two have lived. And I would imagine that out of all the interviews you've done with Hollywood legends, probably less than 20% of that footage ever ended up in the finished products of your movies. What happened to the original tapes of all those interviews?
They're in the Academy, Film Academy archives.
Motion Picture of Arts and Sciences has our whole collection. For research purposes only, it will never be sold to the highest bidder.
No, we were looking for a home. We'd been collecting all these tapes over the years just because we want to make sure they won't get thrown away.
We were always pack rats.
But we know that storage is a big issue in a lot of organizations, and they just throw stuff out. So we deliberately kept as much as we could of the original tapes that we had, and then we tried to find a home for them, because at some point we'll be gone. What will happen to them? And we got a long story short, AMPUS finally agreed to take them in their archive. And as of last December or January, I shipped the last of 26 boxes of tapes.
But you don't own the rights to that footage, so you can't do anything with it, which is really a terrible shame, isn't it?
Well, no. The thing is, we did not fund our own shows. And when you don't fund your own shows, you don't owe anything.
But that's okay, because they have unique stuff that they can show to researchers and not use it. If they don't use it, it's not a problem.
Look, it's there. If somebody wants to use it, they just got to go to the copyright holders and say, we want to use it. But the bottom line is, it's there. It's not been thrown away. It exists.
And I asked certain people if it was okay to send their footage, such as Henry Fonda's widow, who's a great friend of mine, and David's, if it was okay to send her stuff that
she
gave us.
She gave
us
her
home
movies
and slides. And she said, absolutely, give it to them. I asked our friend at Universal if the interview we did with Lou Wasserman and Sid Sheinberg could be given to them. And he said, absolutely, because Lou was on the board of the Academy for all those years. Wasserman, I told everybody I found him adorable. And everybody said to me, Joan, that's not the word people use for Lou Wasserman. I thought he was adorable.
Well, he obviously thought you were adorable, and that sure helped. Now, over the years, you've proposed making films about Cary Grant, Marlene Dietrich, Gene Kelly, Rita Hayworth, Esther Williams, the Gershwin brothers, Barbara Streisand, and you even met with Bette Davis about a film she wanted you to help her with, but none of those ideas ever came to fruition. What would you say was your biggest disappointment in your work as a team?
Cary Grant, because Cary Grant has said yes, and let's face it.
Cary Grant said he'd let us do it, and he owned his clips.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, Cary Grant is still recognized as one of the greatest Hollywood stars of all time.
And there was just a miniseries about him called Archie.
Yes, I know. Yes. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. So it just proves that he's just eternal. He's relevant. He's current. So that was your biggest disappointment?
Probably, because he was...
I would have liked to do Irving Berlin.
Yeah, Berlin would have been...
And I would have loved... I know David's going to kill me for saying this. I would have loved to do Esther Williams. I wanted to be Esther Williams and do the backstroke. I don't know how she ever came out of the water looking gorgeous after all those...
Well, let me tell you something, Joan. With the career you've had, you've been treading water a long time.
Anyway,
so why did you stop making celebrity profile films after the Errol Flynn program?
That was his decision.
You know, it really was my decision in many ways. Well, we'd run out of options from a business point of view. The sort of shows that we were making were quite expensive. We spent a long time making them.
We were known as the expensive documentary producers.
But you have
cleared everything.
Yeah, we were, well, when you're working for Warner Brothers or Universal or Columbia, they insist you clear everything because if anybody's sued, it's going to be them, not us, because they've got the money. So we used to being very meticulous about everything we did, and our shows were not cheap. I mean, we didn't get rich making them, but it cost a lot of money to make them. And we'd reached the point where there were very few takers. Who was going to take our shows anymore? We were down to TCM, basically. Nobody else. A&E, you had the Biography series, remember? They were just very cheaply done. I don't want to knock them, but very cheaply done biographies, taking what we did and doing them quick and dirty, as it were. They wouldn't use film clips. They'd use trailers, for example. And they were okay, and you know, they were very entertaining. But bottom line is, when the show's like that out there, who's going to pay for the expensive version, which is what we did? So we'd pretty much run out of
options.
And
we also started to run out of the kind of stars that would allow people to give us the funding. I mean, you know, we really did do the cream of the crop, in my opinion. And we were lucky that so many of them were still alive and still had their beans, still full of beans.
Yeah.
You know, Katharine Hepburn was almost lost a foot right before the Tracy show. And by the time we did All About Me, she was 85 years old. So we did protection tapes that never been seen, by the way, there at the Academy. And in case we ever needed to piece them together, we had her voice.
But the only answer really to why we stopped is because there was nobody going to buy our shows anymore.
That's just a tragedy. It's just a reflection of the narrow-mindedness and the lack of vision within the industry. Well, I've saved my last question for you, Joan, and it's very important. Are you ready?
It's your moment in the spotlight, Joan.
Am I ready for my close-up? Yes.
You wrote in your book that you took a paper towel from Frank Sinatra's house. So I'm dying to know, have you taken paper towels or anything else from any other celebrities' homes?
Yes. Yes, I collect. According to David, I commit larceny. I steal paper towels. I believe that if you can take a paper towel in a bathroom, wash your hands and throw it in the wastebasket, I can take them as souvenirs. I'm not stealing a terry cloth bath towel, right?
She stole from Frank Sinatra.
I stole from Barbara Streisand. I stole from the White House. I took 12 from the White House because our staff all wanted
The FBI's got her on the table.
And I have one more, Gene Kelly, right?
I think you do.
Did I say Gene Kelly already?
No, you didn't.
Gene Kelly, Barbara Streisand, the White House, and Frank Sinatra.
There you go.
And when I showed you...
And you're going to broadcast this, so everybody will now know that she's a larceny.
Listen, I think it's brilliant. It's better than stealing towels from hotels. These are little pieces that would have gone in the garbage. I love it. I'm with you, Joan. I would have kept it. And I have to tell you both something. Jimmy Stewart once told you that he never treated his audience as customers. He treated them as partners. And it strikes me that that's what you did too in your films. Thank you both for the monumentally important movies you've given us about cinematic history. Thank you for writing the book. And most of all, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
It was our pleasure.
Harvey, it's been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to you. And thank you for your insightful questions. And thank you for your incredible introduction. I didn't know who you were talking about.
Believe me, it all came from the heart. Our guests have been the iconic documentary filmmakers Joan Kramer and David Healy, whose book entitled In the Company of Legends is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.